Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to Fantai, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am entertainment journalist and editor, Travell Anderson.
And I am the man, the myth, the present, Jared Hill. coming up on this week's show.
Okay.
It was either going to be that or I was going to call myself a working homosexual, and I couldn't figure out which one I wanted.
Interesting.
So I just really went with both now at this point.
Choices.
Coming up on the show this week, we are talking about the royals from top to bottom, whether they are white or mixed race with a questionably dark child, or if they are from the land of Zamunda. We are getting into both Harry and Meghan's conversation with Oprah and also Coming to America. But first, let's get into Oprah with Harry and Meghan, or the Meghan Markle interview, as I was calling it. Listen, I was so excited that we had appointment television, and we hadn't had that in so long, so I was really excited about everybody watching something together. Oprah interviewed the Duke and Duchess of some shit, and baby, Oprah, Meghan, and Harry delivered in an
you
interview that lasted...
You are disrespectful.
Listen, they did. They delivered. Oprah says that full interview was 3.5 hours. We watched it for 2 on television, and I probably would have watched all 3.5 if they would have put them out, because I was just kind of like wrapped in it. The Royal Defectors talked about race, suicidal ideation, and blatant lies. There's so much to talk about. We just have like a list of different shit that we could talk about, and we can jump in wherever you want, Travell.
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, so many people seemed to be amazed by how good of an interviewer the Oprah Winfrey is.
What?
And
the one and only.
It just made me go like, oh, y'all must be touched, because this is what she does. It has always done, you know?
To be fair, but like, I think because we don't see Oprah doing these big interviews anymore, it's easy for the girls to forget what a good interview looks like. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody's interviewing, everybody's talking to everybody, everybody's a host now. No shade to the girls.
But all shade to the girls.
But like, you know,
this is the difference. This is the difference between, you know, respectfully, you know, the hosts and the commentators and a journalist.
A journalist. Okay? Because I remember thinking Oprah interviews like someone who is listening, right? Like, you and I talk about panels all the time and the ways that people want us to moderate panels and, you know, could you give me all of your questions and all of this kind of stuff. And I always say in those interviews and in those pre-meetings, like, there's 2 answers. The answer that you want because you're paying me, and like the good true answer. And like the good true answer is, if you've ever been to a panel and it was whack, it's because someone had 10 questions and they asked them in order, right? But like, when you're listening to a good interview like Oprah gave us here, or at a good panel or whatever, you should be able to respond to what the person just said, right? And Meghan gave Oprah so many things where Oprah was like, I'm sorry, wait one more time. You said, you mentioned, yeah.
What it is, right, is it's the art of the follow-up, right?
Absolutely.
It's the art of repeating that which you hear to ensure that you heard it correctly. And then the ways in which that kind of, you know, gets people to give you even a little bit more. But, I mean, I guess we should get into, like, some of the things that she actually revealed, right? Which I think the biggest one maybe was the fact that, you know, the motherfuckers was trying to figure out how dark her child was going to be.
Hold up.
And whether or not her child was going to pass the brown paper bag test. Is what they were trying
acted
to figure
like
out.
The baby was going to come out with dreads like Whoopi Goldberg in a smoker's cough or something. Like, what did y'all think it was going to be?
Well,
like,
they saw her mama. But, they saw her black-ass mama with her black-ass locks, okay?
And her, yeah.
And her nose ring. And they were like, ooh, sugar.
I think that it's not surprising that this conversation was being had by the royals, right? Mm-hmm. It is kind of surprising to hear someone talking about it on the outside. But I think we also have to remind ourselves, like, we are talking about literally the original white supremacists.
Ooh.
Right? Like, they say, like, you go there and it's like white supremacy founded, you know, 1219, whatever the fucking royal family started. So, like, it's not surprising that these people are white supremacists and are worried about, like, the color of their baby. Because the other part of it is, Meghan is so fair that you know, if the hair is pressed just right and the highlight is hit right on that cheekbone the right way, she could pass, right? So the idea that they saw Megan and were like, ooh, we don't know what this nigga child gonna look like. Like, well, what did you think was gonna happen?
Well, somebody is gonna feel a way about you calling, you know, the monarchy, the original white supremacists.
I mean, but, come on. Like,
you know,
hello.
Here we are.
I was also really taken aback by Harry's honesty about not having any perspective on race before having met Meghan. Now, mind you, I'm a little bit challenged by that, but also, like, I appreciate the honesty of a white man saying, like, I really didn't know what the fuck I was talking about, and then I had to do my own work. I appreciated that. I also came away really, really impressed, and not impressed, but grateful for Meghan's discussing of considering suicide. As a person who has had, like, suicidal thoughts and ideation, it is a scary thing to experience, and I cannot imagine what it would feel like to be in that space, in you know, the world that she's in there, and, like, telling them, like, I need help, and then not being able to get it, especially if you're suicidal with a child and, you know, all of the eyes on her. So I really just appreciated that coming from her.
It was interesting because, you know, we don't really, right, get these types of interviews from anyone, right, who's in that rarefied space, right? Whether it's a president, whether it is a king or queen, or, you know, somebody in some sort of kind of royal or kind of elite stature. We don't get these types of interviews really anymore, I feel like.
Yeah,
it's which really also, rare. Which was another reason why Oprah, I think, was the perfect person to do this interview. But I don't know. I when I finished watching it, I was just like, because I found it particularly interesting that she did not Google her man, or the royal family, or anything about, you know, how race might, I guess, seemingly play. It was just, a lot of what she said in terms of how she was initially going into the relationship and initially going into, you know, this role of being part of this family, it just seemed very naive to me, which I found interesting, to say the least, considering who her mom is, you know, what we've been told, at least, about her mom.
So, wait, what have we been told about her mom?
Well, I'm just saying, like, the image that I feel like folks were, like, trying to put out, particularly about her mom, was about, you know, was about the locks. It was about the nose ring. It was about, like, this quote-unquote worldly affectation that she has, or that they felt that people were putting onto her, and how that was supposed to inform Megan's kind of ideas of herself and how she moved through spaces. That being said, right, before she, you know, got into this relationship with Harry, she was an actress, right? She was already in a kind of a rarefied space, even in U.S. terms. And so, you know, and she's mixed race, which that's another thing we haven't talked about, how they kept saying mixed race and nobody said black, which you can do what you do, but I just found that as interesting.
I did find that interesting, too. Now, I want to ask you, we know that you are happily partnered with T.I., right? Mm-hmm. And, well, I shouldn't say T.I. because they're going to be like, are both of y'all under investigation? Yeah. Want to be clear. Texas Isaiah is your partner. Now, you are a... Come back, sugar. I'm sorry. I'd have to do that. But, like, okay. You are a known person, right? Mm-hmm. Who is quite Googleable. How would you have felt, or would you have wanted T.I. to have Googled you when you all started dating?
Well, so here's the thing. I did not Google anything about him. I've never Googled anything about anyone that I have, you know, traipsed with. Is that the right word?
Traipsed? I don't know, but it felt right.
Okay, it did. It did. It felt real good. So I'm not that girl, but I do know of a lot of people who automatically Google, you know, someone before the first date or the second date when they get the first and the last name and they get a general idea of what they do, you know, career-wise, like, whether it's social media and all of that. Like, I've never been that girl. And I can't remember if he I mean, we met on the set of Disclosure, right? So, like, he knew right. a little bit about me just because I was there as talent. But I mean, I don't know. It can feel so, very seedy or iffy or icky, I think, for me when somebody's, like, Googling you to figure out, you know, stuff about you. But I do think the stakes are different when you're a prince.
So, I get that. That's kind of the point that I was making. As someone else who is, you know, pretty Googleable, and it's a very fun search, I promise. I don't want someone to go and, like, Google me before they meet me or go on a date with me or we've, you know, had whatever kind of interaction. And, like, when she said that, I got that because she was also a famous person, right? Like, she's in the fifth season of a popular show or whatever. Mind you, I didn't watch the show, but, like, I know that it was a thing. And so, like, I just want to be clear that, like, I understand the perspective of I didn't want to go, like, do a deep dive of Google on this person because I know what that feels like. And so when I heard her say that, that resonated with me in a way that I was like, I know that most people aren't going to feel that way, but I hear what you're saying. I also want to say that one of the things that I loved out of this, two things. One, all of the new Oprah gifts that we got for sure out of this are make it completely worth it. But I also love the girls getting dragged for their bullshit. So Megyn Kelly tweeted, and we're going to go, Oprah stayed too broad. I wanted more. Who? Be specific. What exactly did they say? Who was jealous of Megyn after Australia? How did you know that? What do you mean your family hasn't, quote, educated themselves the way you have? They're racist? Who? Eventually, they'd have to get specific. Megyn Kelly tweets this out. Now, mind you, Megyn Kelly says this as if Oprah didn't ask those questions, right? But number two, this account called Talk 30 or Talk 30 to Me, they quote tweet Megyn and it says, the lady criticizing Oprah's interviewing skills was paid $30 million to stop interviewing people. Which, if y'all don't know, Megyn Kelly got a lot of money to leave NBC News.
There's a conversation with you.
And so, like, I felt like there were people trying to find ways to criticize Oprah or to criticize the interview, but, like, it was such a good interview. Like, it was...
There's a lot of people that I will, you know, hear critique from, particularly of Oprah and her interview style, and Megyn Kelly is not one.
Hello?
And that's just what it is. Okay.
As you might say, period. Really quickly, in our Dionne Warwick update, I just want to shout out her bio is hilarious to me. Yeah. Not doing that. She has a tweet. Someone tweeted at me something about her bio and, like, can't wait to hear about this on next week's show. And I was like, first of all, fuck y'all. Second of all, it was very funny. My favorite tweet, you pulled this one from Dionne this week.
Yes, I think on Monday, which was yesterday for us as we're recording, she tweeted, the internet isn't that hard. Stop acting so surprised that I'm cool. Smiling face with sunglasses. Wait, why does it say smile? Oh, that was an emoji.
Yeah. Nice work.
I was like, why does the script nice say work. Smiling face with sunglasses? She didn't say that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Coming to America, did we love it? Did we hate it? A little bit of both.
Hey, I'm Janet Varney, host of the JV Club podcast. Ah, high school. Was it a time of adventure, romance, and discovery?
Class of 95, we did it!
Or a time of angst, disappointment, and confusion?
We're all tied together by 4 years of trauma at this place, but enjoy adulthood, I guess.
The truth is, it was both. So join me on the JV Club podcast, where I invite some great friends like Kristen Bell, Angela Kinsey, Oscar Nunez, Neil Patrick Harris, and Keegan-Michael Key to talk about high school, the good, the bad, and everything in between.
My teenage mood swings are getting harder to manage.
The JV Club. Find it on Maximum Fun.
Macho Man to the top rope. The flying elbow. The cover. We've got a new champion!
We're here with Macho Man Randy Savage after his big win to become the new world champion. What are you going to do now, Match?
I'm going to go live listen to the newest episode of the Tights and Fights podcast, oh yeah.
Tell us more about this podcast.
It's the podcast of power, too sweet to be sour, funky like a monkey, woke discussions, man, and jokes about wrestlers' fashion choices, myself excluded, yeah.
I can't wait to listen.
Neither can I. You can find it Saturdays on Maximum Fun. Oh yeah, dig it.
Hear ye, hear ye. Over the weekend, Amazon Prime released the sequel to 1988's Coming to America, the romantic comedy, starred Eddie Murphy as Prince Akeem of the fictional Zamunda, who flees to Queens, New York to find himself and live and all of that. It is what we like to call a blassic, okay? A black classic. Blassic? Blassic. Blassic? Blassic.
Blassic. Just go with the first one.
For whatever reason, somebody was bored one day and said to themselves, I think we should do a sequel 30 years later. And Coming to America was born. The sequel, if you haven't watched, picks up when Prince Akeem is now King Akeem in need of a male heir to the throne because patriarchy doesn't allow his three daughters to assume the throne, whatever. And in course of that, he returns to Queens to find his long-lost son, played by Jermaine Fowler, and bring him back to Zamunda. We wanted to go a little deep on our complex and complicado thoughts about the film. So, if you haven't seen it, this is your spoiler alert warning right here. Put us on pause, go watch it, then come back, okay? Go. So, Jared, to get us started, answer this. What memories, if any, do you have about the first film? Were you excited for the sequel? Are you a big fan of the Coming to America?
So, in truth, I've only seen Coming to America when I was a kid. It wasn't like a movie that I've seen multiple times. I more so know like a lot of the references from Coming to America, a lot of the gifs that we use, a lot of the like video clips that we will share and stuff from Coming to America. But like I actually haven't really watched the whole movie in a long time. So I was coming into this kind of seeing it fresh again. Like I can't remember the last time I saw this movie. What about you?
Yeah, so I know I said that Coming to America is a classic, but you know, it's not one of my.
It's not one of mine. Yeah.
And I never really resonated with the style of comedy that is Coming to America, right? That late 80s, 90s style of comedy. That being said, I can definitely understand why people love the movie, right? It was a huge box office success for Eddie Murphy back in the day. It does have a lot of those classic, you know, comedic references that, like, folks recycle over and over these days. But, yeah, I wasn't really particularly too excited, per se, for the sequel. I mean, I'm always glad that people get in their checks and stuff like that. But I wasn't, like, you know, knocking down the door for this. I don't think anybody, to be clear, asked for a Coming to America sequel.
Well, nobody asked for it, but I was looking forward to it because I love Eddie Murphy. I was excited about all of, I was excited of like, about another like black family reunion kind of movie, you know, where like every black person that was available the week of the cameo window, like we're all there. And so I was excited about that. But one of the things that I've really enjoyed about this, moving into the fan part of this, is like, I remember watching this movie and thinking to myself, I am really loving all of the images that we've had in the last few years of African royalty, whether it is Coming to America, but also Black is King and Black Panther, like seeing like royal black people has just been really, really nice to me. I've enjoyed getting to see like, because we don't see that very often, right? Except for like ancient Egypt and all of those kinds of like historical kind of things. But like all of these places that people have created and imagined, it's been really, really cool to see that.
Oh, you don't like the images of Cleopatra that we've gotten?
Of Elizabeth Taylor, this white woman? Like, what? You know what I mean? Like, so many of the things that we have, I'm like, this is some bullshit. This is some bullshit. This is some bullshit. But like, I've been really, really enjoying getting to kind of see the ways that we imagine African royalty. That was good for me. What about you?
I will say that one of the things I like about just like the idea of doing sequels, generally speaking, and this is, it applies here are the various different cameos that happen, like the ways in which they incorporate, you know, either actors who were in the original film or other people who are just like, you know, part of, you know, the black culture at large, right? So like they Garcelle Beauvais in this, Vanessa Bell Calloway, who was in the original, is in this. For whatever reason, Salt-N-Pepa, En Vogue, and Gladys Knight are also in. Rick Ross got a couple, you know, lines up in here.
Morgan Freeman, reason.
Right?
Lunel has my favorite little don't play at the end. Like, I love that. It's great.
But being, I mean, that's where I have to admit my like of the movie stopped. I also think there is I will save this for the anti part, but I do remind me, I have a response to your comment about African royalty. So remind me, but keep going.
Of course you do, bitch. Okay, I also really loved all of the work Ruth Carter gave us in costuming.
The legendary.
The Oscar award-winning Ruth Carter, costume designer that you might know from plenty of different things, but most recently from Black Panther. I thought the costumes and the sets and all of that, I just thought it was really beautiful and visually stimulating. All of the colors
I
thought were really great.
Shout out to Tyler Perry Studios, which is where they filmed a bulk of it. Right. They also filmed
Rick Ross's home.
Rick Ross's home. Also another shout out for Ruthie Carter. She did the fabulous costumes for the legendary Baps back in the day, starring Halle Berry.
The legendary Baps.
Natalie Dassel Reed. And so Ruthie Carter deserves everything.
Yes.
What else? Anything else that you like really loved or really wanted to highlight before I tear the movie apart?
Oh, listen, because we've got plenty on the other side of this fence, right? But I really enjoyed Leslie Jones in a way that tends to be hit or miss for me. Because sometimes Leslie Jones feels very one note, and then sometimes she feels like perfectly placed. And like in this role, she felt really perfect. And like she stole the film for me. She had a lot of the funniest moments. And like I just kept wanting her to come back. And I was like, I want more of Leslie in this movie. So I really, really enjoyed Leslie Jones.
Can we talk about like how? So I
the
love
the one
Leslie
note thing
Jones.
That she does that Tiffany Haddish also kind of does.
Period. You literally took the entire sentence out of my head. Period. Okay, because I remember when Tiffany Haddish first came on the scene, and every type of role that she had was the you know sassy best friend type of thingamajiggy, right? And you know that's she made a lot of money doing the sassy thing her unique way, and I feel like the same is what we see a lot in terms of like the opportunities, at least, that Leslie Jones has said yes to. Excuse me. That being said, I do watch her on not Clean Sweep. What's the name of the Supermarket Sweep?
Supermarket Sweep.
And she's fucking hilarious, and she's great as the host of that show. But I do remember, like, as I was watching, you know, Coming to America, being like, I wish more for her. But then again, it's like we do a lot of wishing for people and a lot of desires for people. And it's like, she may not fucking want that. Maybe she wants to keep her coins, getting her coins however she getting her coins. Let me mind my fucking business.
So, I mean, I always say the same thing for Leslie and for Tiffany Haddish. And maybe there's an episode in Leslie Jones and Tiffany Haddish, maybe together or apart. I don't know. But like, I always want like Tiffany to come out and like surprise us with something, right? Where we see her, it doesn't have to be in a dramatic role, but it could be a dramatic role, mm-hmm. or just something that shows us another note, right? That shows us another gear that you can go into. Because, I mean, but then we don't really get that from Jennifer Aniston, right? I mean, well, occasionally. I'm thinking about the big white actresses, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think what it is, right? Part of this conversation is also just about like the opportunities afforded to folks. Like, irregardless, I know that's
absolutely
not a word, but y'all leave me alone. Irregardless of, you know, what they choose to say yes to, it's also about like what they have to choose from to say yes to. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, I feel like I bring up Monique as much as possible on this show, but I remember Monique when she was trying to veer into more dramatic roles, she had a lot of issues getting those opportunities because folks were like, I don't want you to make me laugh. right? And she ended up winning the Oscar for Precious. But she only got that role because she had a small role in a film called Shadowboxer, right? In that role, she played a sex worker, if I'm not mistaken. And she talked about how, you know, she was told in her audition, if you make me laugh, you're not going to get this job, right? And how she just had to give of herself in that particular way. And she did amazing at it. But yeah, I don't know. Again, I think part of this is also just about us, you know, projecting our desires for folks onto them when, like, maybe right. They don't even fucking care.
I mean, Tiffany Haddish and Leslie Jones might feel like, oh no, I love this lane and I want to kill this lane and I'm right. going to exploit it for all it's worth. And if that is the case, turn up. Like,
go for it.
I might not be there for all of it, but, like, turn up.
So let's get into the anti of the film, which I think will probably be the bulk of our conversation. You go first.
Okay, so I'm really troubled that we made the choice for the premise of this movie.
Don't say we.
I want to be clear that I'm using the royal we. Yeah. You see
we
what
get
I...
It. Not that funny.
Okay. So the... But we made the choice to do a whole premise of a movie that's based on a date rape. Like, in a post-Bill Cosby world? Like, I was really taken aback in the moment. Like, no. And I was thinking, like, I know this movie was done, like, 2 years ago. No, we knew about Bill Cosby then. Like, I was really taken aback that was the premise that they decided to like, root this in.
And it's also one of those things where I think there's a lot of people who will watch Coming to America and not pick up on that seedy nature of that one night stand, right, that gives us this son that Eddie Murphy's character apparently has. It definitely is one of those moments that makes you go, And I feel like there were a lot of those moments, for me at least, throughout this entire film that made me struggle to actually enjoy it. And part of it being, like I mentioned earlier, that's the style of comedy. I felt like they were literally just trying to do, you know, another version of the original Coming to America. And they I felt like it was like similar comedy beats, but I don't know if that style of comedy really flies and is it really useful and good in 2021. And so there was a little just kind of dissonance for me in trying to like resonate and laugh with it. Like it felt very you know back in the day when you was on the playground and there was, you know, as someone who came to your school from, you know, insert country from Africa here, and all of the little kids used to call them African booty scratchers. As a joke, right? But that was like super offensive and all of that.
Wow.
That is what it felt like to me, right? Having these black American white people.
One of the white people just paused and said, "What?"
But that's what it felt like to me. It felt
I
very...
did that. It felt out of date.
It felt very dated, and it also felt we also haven't talked about just like the idea of Black American people playing and taking on these like African affectations, which was like, you know, the root of the original film, which I think contributed to the comedy nature of it all. But in 2021, it just felt like, and then y'all also like the sequel ended up being like a who's who of Black American folks, and it's like, I feel like in 2021, give me some, you know, homegrown talent, you know, and I'm sure they had some folks mixed in, but it just wasn't enough for me, I feel like, in 2021 of it all.
Interesting. One of the major things that I walked away with, and I should have said this earlier, I overall enjoyed the movie, but I didn't think it was a good movie, mm-hmm. right? Like, I thought it was entertaining. I laughed a lot. I thought it was beautiful, you know, all of the different things. But I didn't think, oh, this is a really good movie. I'm entertained enough to watch it again. But I would say that I really thought they told the wrong story. And you gave it those words when I was talking to you about this before.
Yeah.
But I thought, number one, those three daughters of his... were way more interesting to me than this son that we didn't know existed that you then went and found because patriarchy. And it just seemed to me that, like, it would have been way more interesting to tell the story of him passing the torch or what have you to his daughter and how amazing that was without having to, like, go through all the bullshit first to get there, right? Like, it would have been really cool to see her go to America to find a man as opposed to, like, us trying to create this other thing. And I just thought, like, it also made me, by the end of it, I was thinking to myself, like, I really want to see the show about those three girls. Like, they're all African warrior princesses. Like, that's amazing.
We should say those characters are played by Kiki Layne, who was great in If Beale Street Could Talk, if you all saw that. Also, she was the young black lead in The Old Guard from last year. She killed that role as well. So Kiki Layne, Bella Murphy, which is Eddie Murphy's daughter, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then Keely... or Kylie Love are their names. I agree with you that they definitely told the wrong story. And you can tell that they tried. It's also hard with a lot of sequels, and I promise this will make sense. They try to be so self-referential and I think self-acknowledging in that it is a movie 30 years later. And, like, they obviously are having some sort of commentary throughout the film about this traditional idea that a man must take, you know, the throne and that a woman can't, or at least historically and traditionally hasn't, and that type of stuff. But so much of that ends up being, you know, on the floor and, like, not really grappled with, but just kind of injected every now and again in somebody's comment that makes me feel as if, oh, it was an afterthought. You know, like
I get that. This was part of the punch up.
Right. This was a part of you also trying to make this movie somehow relevant and of the times for 2021, when in reality, you should have just told the story about how this black girl comes to be, you know, the first queen of Zamunda or something like that.
Yeah. I think I'm really excited that our black offerings are getting smarter, right? Like, they're getting more, they're having something more to say.
Do you think this is an example of a smarter form of black art?
Sweetie, we're in the anti. Do you think that's where that's going?
Okay, I'm just have to check.
I just, like, let's be real here. But, like, Black Panther, for instance, right? I was talking about African royalty. Black Panther felt smart and thoughtful and, like, beautiful and exciting and all of these different things. Black is King. Like, there's things about royalty in there, right? It's obviously the story of Simba and it felt artistic, and, you know, people feel different ways about Beyonce. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. But, like, then coming to America just felt a little lazy when it came. Like, the writing of this movie was really the big problem, right? Like, the writing was just not there. And I felt like it wasn't smart enough for where we are as a culture now, especially with, like, our big ticket black shit.
You know, so I have a piece coming out. We're recording on Tuesday. The piece actually comes out on Wednesday. So by the time y'all hear this, you can check it out over at Extra Magazine, which I think gets a little bit at your point about the writing of it all. And, like, in particular for me, there's one joke in particular that really kind of was the, what they call it, the camel that broke the back, the hay.
The straw that broke the camel's back.
That one.
So as we go to this point, I want to admit that I didn't know what to do in that moment. And I wanted to call my trans friends and be like, is this problematic? But then I also kind of felt like the white person calling black people to be like, is this problematic? So then I didn't do it. And I just kind of sat there and interrogated it with myself, like, well, okay, so go ahead.
So early, I think within the first 30 minutes or so of the film, Eddie Murphy's character, Prince Akeem, or King Akeem, returns to Queens, like we said, to look for his son. And he goes to a barbershop, which is one of the sites that his younger self in the original often went, and you know, as is the case in real life barbershops, the barbers are giving all sorts of social commentary about a lot of things. And it's
usually trash.
Right. And it's in this scene that a lot of that commentary, just to kind of show us where we are in the world, is, right? So there's commentary about gentrification in New York. There's commentary about, you know, one of the barbers who wants a Tesla, right? There's conversations about the resurgence of Nazis, right? And we should say, the majority of the characters in this scene are played by Arsenio Hall and Eddie Murphy in prosthetics, okay? And there's this moment, there's this joke that is done by one of Eddie Murphy's characters, basically in which he's talking to King Akeem and he asks.
Wow.
He asks King Akeem if he has children. And the barber says, oh, I have a granddaughter who used to be my grandson. They can turn your penis into a vagina now. It's science. And that's the quote. And that's the joke. And I remember having to pause. I remember pausing. And I saw this like a month and a half ago or whatever. I remember pausing, being just like so upset and so disappointed. One, because it wasn't funny. And then two, because it was like one of those cursory trans inclusion moments that a lot of people and a lot of creators in particular like to do with their work to show how of the times it is, but not really grappling with actually including trans people, you know, for example, you know.
Sure.
And it was just something that for me was like, okay, but this is the type of movie I'm going to be watching. And I continued it because I did want to see how it finished. But like, that was one of those moments that made me go, y'all need to, cis people, the headline for the story is cis people need to mind their own business. Okay, they need to stay out of trans people's business. Okay, and this is one of those situations where it was just like, I don't know if I can go as far as saying it was transphobic.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely was unnecessary. And I have a whole lot of thoughts in the piece about like what type of language we can use to denote how the specificity around how anti-trans it is. You can read the piece. I'm not going to say that here. But it definitely was one of those moments where I was just like, here y'all go again, just being dense for no fucking reason. And I think that that type of joke reflected the other types of jokes that we got, particularly, and other conversation that we got, particularly around the moments that was supposed to signal to us that, you know, the film was happening in 2000, whatever, and not 1988 or whatever. And I think that that was a severe failure on behalf of the writers and all the other nignogs who said the words, saw the words, approved it, etc.
And that's that on that. I mean, I think you kind of encapsulated that really well. One, I love the piece of analysis that you gave, that like the barbershop is the opportunity for them to kind of show where we are as society, because I think that's a really spot on critique, and I hadn't thought about it in that lens. But yeah, I think because of all of the things that we're talking about, right? Like how it didn't feel as smart as it could have. It didn't feel like it was as progressive as it pretended to be. It made it feel like, oh, this could have came out 10 years ago. And maybe that the using of the date rape thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of feels like right now when you're watching something and you see like a big crowd of people, you immediately know that this was pre-COVID. Like the way that they handled some of that, like the date rape thing immediately made me feel like, oh, this is set at least 5-10 years ago.
But it also goes to show, it also, I think, tells you who the creators of this are.
That's fair.
You know, like, I think it's an automatic signal. Even, there's also another scene in the barbershop in which they are, like, joking about not being able to basically harass and molest women anymore.
Yes.
Right? And it's like,
yes.
You're not being as, I think, conscious as you think you're being. Like you're
but
actually
see,
being...
I don't know that they're even thinking about having been conscious. To me, it feels like we were talking about earlier, it feels like a punch up, right? Like someone got the script and then they went through it to add in little moments that were funnier to them. And like, that's how we got some of those moments in there. But like, it just doesn't feel like it was a modern day script. But then again, I mean, this movie was shot 2 years ago, but even that, like, I don't know that that's enough of a time gone by for
it's
any
not.
Of this to be excusable.
It's not. It also just, like, there were just some a number of things that just were like, like, it just wasn't necessary. And it I felt think lazy. We should also recognize as we wrap up, right, that, like, you know, we're coming at this conversation from a particular perspective, right, as younger people, as queer people, as, you know, progressive people, et cetera, right? But, you know, it just... Go ahead.
Overall, I did really enjoy it. Like, again, like, I thought the movie was funny in a lot of different places. I thought it was beautiful to look at. I loved all of the moments that, like, made me laugh or kind of, you know, made me feel nostalgic. But, like, there were a lot of moments where I was like, this could have really been something more. But,
I just kept asking myself why.
Yeah.
Like, why does this movie exist? Like, I understand y'all want to get y'all checks and y'all want to get y'all coins. And I want you to get your coins, too. Don't get me wrong. But why? You know, it just did not feel... I feel like so many other sequels that I love, you know, they... One of my favorite movies is a sequel. Sister Act 2. Okay?
Absolutely.
And you feel a purpose, I think, behind that sequel. I'm also thinking about the Legally Blonde sequel. I'm also thinking about even the Best Man, the Best Man franchise now. Those sequel, that sequel... like they all seem to have a purpose and an energy behind them. And this felt very, it just felt very flat, for all of the reasons we've listed.
It feels like the difference between I've got a great story and we've got a great movie to do another one of. You know what I mean? Like, I've got a great story is like, oh, this is a really great take on how we can extend the life of Coming to America, as opposed to the 30-year anniversary is coming up. We should do something.
But what at the core of all of this, right? Because we also haven't talked about how this movie fits into the broader reboot craze, right? And the sequel craze that's happening in the industry where we're revisiting, right? And reviving old IPs, right? Mm-hmm. For the sake of stuff. And, like, this is an example, I think, of when it's wrong and when it doesn't work. You know, maybe they should have just given us a whole new cast, you know, or something completely different, you know, a la, you know, the Saved by the Bell series or, High School Musical, the musical, the series.
Okay. You know what? This is a good place to get out. While we're asking the question of why, when we look at Twitter, we'd love to know why you liked or hated or were fan-tie about the movie. You can tweet at us using hashtag FanTieFam, and our handles on Twitter and Instagram are at FanTiePodcast. Want to know what made your list of the fans and the anti's. Coming up, why y'all hate us so much, and listener feedback and dishonorable mentions right after that. Don't go anywhere. You need to unwind after a long day of Zoom calls.
I hate you looking, so much.
Looking for some new self-care ideas? Or maybe you're just looking for a way to get out of a funk and start feeling like yourself again?
Mm-mm.
Reset and reconnect with yourself with Dipsy. That's right. Dipsy is an audio app full of short, sexy stories designed to turn you on. Each Dipsy story features characters that feel like real people in immersive situations and scenarios, so you feel like you're right there. Dipsy also has wellness sessions to help you learn more about yourself and bedtime stories and soundscapes to help you relax before you drift off. Dipsy is a fantastic app. I've actually checked it out, and I think it's pretty dope. I enjoy the stories. I told you that they have Sarunas Jackson from Insecure on the doing
you
stories
be,
on there.
You be living your wildest fantasies via Dipsy?
I don't know that I'm living my wildest fantasies. I mean,
so they could get wilder. Understood.
That's not what... Listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering a 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/fantai. That's a 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/fantai. dipsystories.com/fantai.
Fantai is also brought to you by the one and only Raycon. Okay, whether you're an avid news watcher or in need of a serious distraction, unplugging yourself is easier said then done, okay? Give your eyes a break from your screens and get the content you crave with Raycon wireless earbuds. I told y'all last year, okay, when the people above me, okay, was doing whatever they were doing at all times of days, okay, I was able to pop in my Raycon earbuds and I didn't hear none of their foolishness, okay? One of the benefits is there are no dangling wires or no stems to get in your way. They come in a range of stylish colors, but always with a comfortable in-ear fit for a more discreet look. Raycons are built with water and sweat-resistant construction. That way, you know, if you got wet ears, okay, you don't have to worry about, you know, a malfunction.
Or if you're working out.
That too. You don't have to worry about no malfunctions, okay? And Bluetooth that pairs quickly and seamlessly and without and with enough battery life for 6 hours, all right? The best part, Raycon makes great sound accessible to everyone with wireless earbuds starting at half the price of other premium audio brands, okay? So Raycon is offering 15% off all of their products for our listeners, and here's what you got to do to get it. Go to buyraycon.com/frantide. That's it. It's simple. It's real easy, okay? You'll get 15% off your entire Raycon order, so feel free to grab a pair and a spare. That's 15% off at buyraycon.com/frantide. Buyraycon, RAYCON.com/frantide.
Did I tell you my parents called and were like, oh my God, we love our Raycons? They were really excited.
Well, shout out to them. All right, beautiful people, it's time to get into our listener feedback segment. But before we do that, we want to remind you all about your merchandise, okay? You can get your Fanti merch. It's available for pre-order through, I believe it's Friday, March 12th at midnight Pacific time, okay?
So not Pacific time. But you have all day Thursday and all day Friday at midnight Pacific.
Yes.
Okay. Every time say Pacific, I think I'm saying specific wrong. So, sorry.
Interesting. So, yes, make sure y'all check that out. Get your merch, okay? It will disappear from the page, after Friday. And then we'll begin getting them produced and shipped out to the folks who've already bought stuff. All right, let's get into some of the emails. We got a lot of feedback, I think, from last week's episode, Funky Covidina, all about the vaccine, and our A segment about the rise in anti-Asian racism. We've got an email here from Cynthia, who is a pediatrician, responding to that episode, who just wanted to add just a little bit more context. She says, as another healthcare professional, I wanted to add just one thing to all the awesome things Nurse Alice and Dr. Darian shared, and that is, although there is some discussion about the comparative efficacy of the different vaccines, those differences refer to the risk of being infected with COVID at all. She underscored that every vaccine that is currently approved is 100% effective at preventing death from COVID. This is a remarkable thing and a very important point. So whenever any vaccine is available to you, please get whichever one it is, because all of them will equally prevent you from dying from this disease. She just wanted to add that particular point. So shout out to her.
Shout out to Cynthia. That's a really great piece of information. If we were like at a live panel event and one of us was hosting and she got up to the mic and did that, we would be calling her fourth panelisting. Like, she's trying to be the fourth panelist right now. But in this context, Cynthia, it works very well. Thank you for that. No, that's really important information. So shout out to her. We also got an email from Jessamine, who, as I put my glasses on to read the screen, I feel like I'm 75,000 years old. The email says, but you have to do it too, so it's fine. Hi, Jarrett and Travelle. Over the last couple of months, I've heard a lot of people in media talk about people of color getting the vaccine at a lower rate. They have almost always talked about how trust in the healthcare system is low given the horrors of Tuskegee. We know from polling studies and common sense that if you make a statement and then ask a question, the content of the preceding statement can have a substantial effect on how people answer the question, which is an interesting point. She goes on to say, my concern is that if people are hearing commenters talk about Tuskegee in low trust, in healthcare in the context of a conversation that implicitly asks listeners to think about the choice they're going to make about getting the vaccine, then people may say to themselves, maybe I won't get the vaccine because they have just been reminded of the reasons for distrusting the medical system. She goes on to ask two specific questions. One, do people in the media have a responsibility to think about the all of the possible consequences of how they talk about stuff like this? And secondly, how do commenters like yourselves responsibly talk about the history and present-day racism in the healthcare system in a way that doesn't compound the problem of Black people choosing not to get the vaccine, which then compounds the problem that Black people are more negatively affected by COVID? Love the show. Thanks very much. Jessamine, thank you for that. Travell, I'll let you answer first.
So I reject the idea that as folks are listening to things that you know, we're in this society and in this world now where people like to splice up things, right? People like to listen to one part of something and not listen to the rest of it, right? But they go run with that one part that they listen to. And I think that's just the nature of like consumption in media wise. And so I think when we're having this conversation about like the responsibility, it's got to be twofold. I think we have to talk about the responsibility of consumers and then responsibility of us as commentators. I just hit the table. Jordan gonna be mad at me.
I literally thought Jordan gonna whoop your ass.
But you know, I talk with my hands and stuff. Anyway, So I think that for me, it is important to acknowledge the history, and it's also important at the same time to move past that history. And I think it's interesting to kind of contextualize this as, you know, the ways in which we are talking about people's hesitancies and Tuskegee and like the very real racism that people are facing today and how that might contribute to people, Black people in particular, continuing to have concerns, right? And continuing to have trepidation when it comes to the health establishment. But I think that's also where like Black health providers come in. And to be clear, that's not to say that Black folks will, you know, automatically be the saving grace, right, for us in a lot of these, you know, health environments. There's a really great episode, I promise you it's related, of The Good Doctor, in which fat Black woman comes in, she's having issues, and the Black doctor who's on the team basically doesn't believe her and basically, you know, recommends various treatment based off of her assumptions because of this woman's body, because of her assumptions about these people, and how the Black woman ends up, you know, staging this whole potential campaign to like get her fired and sue the hospital and all of that. But I say all that to say, I do think that like us engaging with and being specific, right, about speaking to Black doctors for us was a way to circumvent that kind of trepidation that I think sometimes people can, that can be compounded on people's already present issues. What about you?
So to the two questions, I want to answer them separately. The first question being, do people in the media have a responsibility to think about all the possible consequences of how they talk about stuff like this? Number one, if you listen to the show long enough, you know that I believe responsibility is something you take on. That's something that's put onto you. So it's hard for me to say like you have a responsibility to do this because you are a broadcaster. But I would also say that you have to consider the medium, right? Like, it's not just the person in the media, but the medium. So like the fact that this is a podcast where we have this conversation, and I'm not saying that, Jessamine, you're attacking us. I'm more so laying it out from the landscape sake. But like on a podcast where we have like lengthy discussions about stuff like this, I think it's important to be able to kind of provide all those different pieces of context that are a part of the conversation that we're having about these things. Whereas if I were the local news and we had, you know, 90 seconds to have a conversation about the vaccine and the numbers, then it is a much lesser priority, I think, to be able to include all of that context and remind people of that. To your second question, how do commentators like yourselves responsibly talk about the history and present-day racism? And you went forward with more of a question there. It depends on the context. I wanted to call attention to like our Black History episode that we did at the beginning of February. It was called Every Day is Black History. And we reversed the format of that episode to be anti-first and fan at the end. And we've done that a couple of times on the show because sometimes there's something that we're talking about that we don't want to leave a bad taste in your mouth about the thing, right? Like if we really think it is a good thing overall, I know Eddie Murphy right now is, but you didn't do that for me, motherfucker.
Oh my God.
Shout out to Eddie Murphy. We know he listens to the show. And so I want to just point out that, like, in some of those instances, we will frame it a little bit differently because it's important to remind people that this thing is important. The vaccine episode, for instance, we didn't do an anti-deep dive on, like, fuck the medicine system and, you know, Black female mortality rates. And look, we didn't do all of that, right? Like, we kind of presented it in a way that kind of gave a little bit more of a comprehensive perspective, but then really talked about why it was important.
And then I also want to say, like, what is the alternative, right, of not talking about the very real issues that people have experienced both historically and present day? Yeah. What is the alternative? Do we not reference those things at all? I don't know. I feel like I want to, as a consumer, as somebody who has to go into these spaces as a patient, like, I want to be as well equipped as possible with all of the questions, with all of the understanding of what has happened historically, what might happen today, and how we actually want it to go. That way, you know, I can be equipped, right, to call out something as I see it happening, as opposed to being on the end of the interaction and then feeling like shit, feeling like my needs weren't treated. I don't know, but that's actually an interesting question from Jessica.
I think it's a really good question, and I mean, overall, I think one of the things that is distinct about this show is we are journalists, right? And so whereas if you were listening to The Read, they're commentators, right? They are comics and
exclusively, like, commentators,
right? Yeah. Exactly. And so they're kind of giving their opinion, whereas if you're on Still Processing, for instance, that is all about, like, you know, it is very scripted and really tightly discussed. So I think it's important to also kind of consider where you're getting the information, what you're talking
about. They're not calling really great question. Knobs and bitches on Still Processing.
Wow. Shout out to Megyn Kelly. Okay, so it is, I think I did something there, but I didn't, but I did, but it's fine. It's time for Dishonorable Mentions. These are the stories or people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out, either for, I think I just called Megyn Kelly a,
I think you did too. I don't think either for their did that. You didn't do that.
I mean, I kind of
No, you didn't.
Didn't. No, no, you okay. Didn't. Either for their good or for their... Oh, God. Okay. What a moment. Okay. Wow. Okay. My first honorable mention this week is going to go to the one and only B. Scott. I'm giving that hard T because I always love the way B. Scott used to give the T. Right. A. Love Muffins. I want to give a shout out to B. Scott. Variety announced on Tuesday that B. Scott, you may know them from their huge entertainment gossip site, lovebscott.com. They're going to be the first non-binary transgender host on BET, hosting a series that will follow 20s from Lena Waithe and, like, discussing the episode. And that's a pretty big deal. If you remember, B. Scott had a really big lawsuit with BET years ago over their treatment of them on the purple carpet at the BET Awards probably 4 or 5 years ago. So congratulations to B. Scott, and happy to see this move from BET.
Yeah, B. Scott was also one of my mentions as well. For those who aren't familiar with the history, I wrote a piece in advance of the 20s season one premiere at Zora magazine, which is one of the medium publications that, like, kind of recounts BET's history with LGBTQ folks, broadly speaking, including B. Scott. So that's some, like, you know, starter information for you. But it's definitely great to see B. Scott return to the network. They also released kind of an open letter of sorts via GLAAD, basically talking a little bit about their gender journey, because their gender journey was, you know, part of the hubbub around BET yanking them off the carpet. I believe in 2013 was the year. And so yeah, shout out to B. Looking forward to see what brilliance they bring to BET for sure.
I also want to give a shout out or an honorable mention here to none other than It's loading. I saw this Instagram post on it's Dizzy Don't Play 357 with underscores. I don't know what that means, but it's a photo that is from Upper Manhattan, and it's a sign that's written on a staircase, and the sign says, "Don't gentrify our neighborhood and then make noise complaints." All of Dyckman. Dyckman is the whole street, that area. And then there's like a little note underneath it that says, "We hear Jersey is really quiet." And like, I just thought it was hilarious that people are dealing with gentrification in this way. We were just talking about gentrification in Coming to America. I thought this sign was really funny.
Cute. I want to give an honorable mention to the one and only.
That cute was so rude.
You're welcome. To the one and only T.S. Madison, former sex worker who's now kind of a social media maven. She has a fabulous reality TV show on WeTV called The T.S. Madison Experience. It is hilarious. And so everybody just needs to tune in, download the WeTV app if you don't have WeTV, or you can get it on your Apple TV or whatever the case may be. I want everybody to make sure they check out this show, because she's always been hilarious, but then to see her like in her element with her own show, her own platform, it's really, really fun.
All right. And then I want to give a dishonorable mention to Piers Morgan. If you all know Piers Morgan, he is a British broadcaster. Who essentially fucked Piers Morgan. Piers walked off of the set of their Good Morning Britain, which is obviously like our Today Show or Good Morning America, when one of the co-hosts took him to task for the comments that he made about Meghan Markle the day before. Piers Morgan has been, incredibly critical of Meghan Markle throughout the entire time that we've known who she was. Fun fact, he had gone on, I believe, a date or had a call with her the day she met Prince Harry, and he never heard from her again. So, his feelings, he's a little salty, right? But he also has always been an asshole. So, fuck Piers Morgan, and a dishonorable mention for you.
Listen, Piers has been trash for years, okay? Hell, decades. Indeed. At this point. He ain't nothing but a knockoff Simon Cowell, okay?
Wow. Yeah, that's fair. I'll take that.
All right. In this week's Black History is Happening Every Day moment, cue the song, Jordan. Black History is happening every day. Boop. We are revisiting a iconic moment in television once again. We wanted to keep this in the theme of the show. And so it is Oprah. It's all about Oprah. And there's this particular moment back in the day on her show. She's interviewing someone who came up with this $1 million award-winning chicken recipe, okay? And she's just about to take the first bite. Take a listen.
So you're supposed to eat the two together?
Yeah. Do you like it? I hope so. Just say yes.
No, wait, no! I do like it. I like it very much. I think, did we add salt and pepper? I think we needed salt and pepper.
No, there's no salt and pepper in it. You can add it yourself.
I would just like, I think it's delicious is what it really is.
Maybe it's batch.
Okay.
Oprah does try to redeem herself at the end there, but you can tell that she was really struggling with this chicken, and the white lady just really wanted her to say she liked it.
Okay, but this white lady literally got on national television and said, "Oh no, there's no salt and pepper in it." Girl, what is wrong with you?
Right, the look on Oprah's face when she says no to the salt and pepper, she's like, "What do you mean?" I love that moment. So shout out to Oprah Winfrey for being a legend.
Yeah, shout out to her. All right, we're going to wrap up the show. First and foremost, we want to, again, remind you all about merch. The deadline is March 12th. Make sure you grab yours. Grab some great options there. And I want to point your attention to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I joined them this week. I believe it's going to air on Friday, so tomorrow, if you're listening to this episode on Thursday. Be sure to check it out. I don't think I'm supposed to tell you what we're talking about, but you know if I'm there, it's a good old Kiki time, honey.
You know if Travelle's going to be there, you should have a cocktail and be ready for a nap because you're going to be exhausted.
Wow.
If this conversation piqued your
interest. Wow, coming in hot there.
If this conversation piqued your interest and you want more of this,
goo goo.
Check out our other episodes that have related conversation, like Forever for Always for Black Love, featuring Tessa Thompson and Namdi Asomugha. It's episode number 46. It is a great conversation about their movie, Sylvie's Love, a fantastic Black movie that I really enjoyed. We ask that if you are listening to this show on Apple Podcasts, we ask that you leave a 5-star rating and a review on iTunes because it really helps the show. If you have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us or hit us up on Instagram at Fanti Podcast. You can follow us on both and use the hashtag FantiFam to jump into the conversation.
And as always, you can send us your feedback, your thoughts, your comments, your suggestions for other podcast episode ideas to Fanti@MaximumFun.org. What did I say? Fanti@MaximumFun.org is the
email. Have you heard of this show?
Every now and again. And if you would like to become a member of the Fanti Fam and the Maximum Fun family, you can become, you can join at MaximumFun.org/join.
Music is by Corrice. You can get his music wherever you get your Slayworthy audio. That's Cor.ece. Our graphics and photos are by Ashley Nguyen. Our producers are Jordan Kallick and Laura Swisher.
So I will say I was trying to figure out something that was like deeply African and, you know, royal of a sound to make, but then I didn't want to be offensive, so I just decided not to.
I think you made a good call. I think you made a good choice. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
I noticed that because when I copied it in from Twitter, the document.
Oh, so this is
that.
Your fault that I read it wrong. Understood.
It is, and I'm going to accept responsibility for that and promise you it was not sabotage.